for argument this morning is Merriman Excavation against the Operating Engineers Union. Mr. Avakian.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Avakian, and I represent Merriman Excavation in this appeal from the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. The questions that are posed by this case are in fact, somewhat troubling because of the history that's dealing with joint grievance committees and the question of arbitration under Section 301 of the Labor Act. However, based upon this Court's precedent and clear precedent in Thomas almost 21 years ago, there is a requirement that joint grievance committee members be both fair and impartial.
Do they have to be as fair and impartial as federal judges?
No, the case law, Your Honor, appears to indicate no. But I would point the court to consolidated the U.S. Supreme Court's decision.
Thomas, in fact, recognized in the footnote that we really don't expect union and employer representatives on these committees to be completely objective, do we?
I believe the expectation is as you say, Your Honor, and that is but. Because of that particular problem that had arisen, the court imposed a duty that they actually be fair and impartial.
Well, that was with respect to the union rep with a fair duty of fair representation to the union member, right?
But in the context of that case, that is correct. But also in the context of the case, because was a hybrid duty of fair representation case, the employer representatives also had an obligation to be fair and impartial. And so the court's requirement would have to be that these people had to be fair and impartial. Because
how does your argument apply, let's say, to three-member arbitration panels where each party picks one member and then those two pick a neutral?
That is more evident of arbitration. As the academics talk about the joint grievance committees, this is not arbitration. This is something actually different.
So the standard for objectivity and impartiality is higher under your theory for joint grievance committee members?
No, I'm not saying that's the case. What I'm saying
is we expect union member reps to represent union interests and employer reps to represent employers.
I think there's an understanding that each of them come from a particular community, mm-hmm. that and at the joint grievance committee board they may bring their experiences to bear at that point in time. But when they're listening to a grievance that comes before them, as the Supreme Court has indicates, they put an arbitrator's essentially hat on, and they have to deal with that grievance fairly and impartially, because unless that system is dealt with that way, then the entire prospect of encouraging voluntary arbitration as part of Section 301 and the labor laws would be totally undermined, because it would then become anything but a neutral process, which Professor Summers explains very clearly that this is what's going on. There's trading of grievances. There's everything but the accommodation of the individual's rights, which Thomas basically recognized. And the only way out of that, which I think this court looked at, was the fact that we have to impose a standard of impartiality and non-bias. The interesting part of this particular case is right at the get-go, at the beginning of the case, the union denied that their members sitting on the JGC, the Joint Grievance Committee, had any duty to be impartial and non-biased. They took it as a freewheeling continuation of the contract.
Are you talking about the part of the answer?
Part of the answer.
Where your paragraph referred to people who were members of the Joint Grievance Committee as well as some people who were not members of the Joint Grievance Committee?
Including all the above, correct.
Okay. And so they denied that as pled.
Correct.
Now, does that equate with a denial of the fairness of the folks who actually voted? When you put them all in one paragraph.
Exactly, Your Honor. They were all okay. The lawsuit was against.
So you're not saying the union's denying the fairness of their voting members, are you? You're not reading the answer that way, surely.
Well, they may argue that.
You chose to put all those names together, right?
Right. And they blanket said they deny there was that obligation.
As pled.
Correct.
Okay.
So that's where the case starts. And I would argue that starting at that point, we now know that the JGC at least the inference is the JGC was not.
No, we don't know that. Okay. Given the way you pled it.
Well, I mean, I believe under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, you have an obligation if you don't agree with some part of an answer, or rather a complaint paragraph, the affirmative, you have an obligation to deny part and answer affirmatively part. Or if you can't answer it, explain why you can't answer it. Because then there's other mechanisms that can come into play. But bottom line, I mean, we're talking about some of the standards to begin with. But in this particular case, and we can get to the actual fact of bias and partiality by the record that was presented here in the grievance hearings. And it's very clear from the statements that were made what that would be. But to understand the kind of the context, there's that's required are some simple facts from the contract itself, which is one that the contract has a management rights clause. Secondly, that there is a zipper clause, an integration clause, that says there's no agreements outside of what's set forth in this document, oral or written. Thirdly, in the joint grievance, or rather in the grievance provision of Article 13, there is the requirement that the joint grievance committee be composed of equal numbers of persons from labor and persons from the employer side. So that's a requirement. Shortly after, in that very same provision, the CBA sets forth the fact that the joint grievance committee cannot alter, detract from, or add to the contract. So everything that's in the contract regarding all its points cannot be adjusted by the joint grievance committee. What we have here is a kind of a flip on the contract, where I'm jumping a little forward in what I want to argue, but we have the compensation of a member. The actual requirement and the beneficiaries of a collective bargaining agreement are the members. They're the ones that get at work hours and get paid for the jobs that they perform. It's not the union. They're not the beneficiaries of that contract. In the contract itself, in the Article 1, Section 11, it specifically provides that the employers and the assignment of work or the misassignment of work, the employer must compensate the bargaining union member two times the rate that he should have gotten. And it specifically says it's compensate the bargaining unit member. In this particular case, in all but two grievances, they compensated the union. The Joint Grievance Committee told Merriman that you violated the contract in some means because we have no explanation from the Joint Grievance Committee at all, and paid the union a total of $88,000 collectively for these grievances.
I assume that's for a lot of different employees who weren't there, I guess.
We don't know, Your Honor. A couple times through the hearing, and there are references, I believe, in our brief, the union made reference to the fact that they had an out-of-work list. Well, we asked for the out-of-work list. At the hearing, before the hearing, so we could identify who the aggrieved person might have been who was entitled to the alleged benefits. As part of the underlying hearing of the case, the union also informed Judge Kendall that during most of this period in 2006, there were no people in their hiring hall. They're on the bench. There's nobody to be assigned this work. And that's a fundamental issue because in arbitration, unless there's an injured party, unless somebody has actually lost pay, you can't make a payment and complete the arbitration process. You don't have a grievance if you don't have an injury, just like in the law. And that's not been disputed in this case so far. The evidence of partiality and bias are twofold. One comes from the actual sitting on the joint grievance committee. I'm not just a random number of union business agents, but one of their officers, it's himself. And it was the recording secretary, Mr. Sisko. And not only did he write up the grievance that the union submitted to the joint grievance committee, he informed Merriman that his written grievance was going to lead to step two in the process and ultimately to the joint grievance committee. So he writes the grievance, identifies that X number of dollars are in play, sits on the joint grievance committee, that helps decide, apparently helps decide the decision, and directs all the money to be sent to the union. Now, the employer reps, on the other hand, have testified in their affidavits, which are a part of the record, that they don't have any idea what this Local 150 Assistance Fund is. Somehow they're just going ahead and dumping money into the union, which creates another all the problems, not only because they're not identified as an entity entitled to any benefits under a collective bargaining agreement for lost wages, but to make them a beneficiary changes the contract, which they are specifically forbidden from doing in the collective bargaining agreement. That's altering or modifying the agreement to add a new term. And giving the money in this way also imposes a public policy issue, which is it appears to breach Section 302 of the Labor Act by having an employer give money to a union. And when 302 provides the only exemption being for money to a union official if he's an employee, so that we don't have money going around back and forth and undermining the policies of corruption that the Congress specifically tried.
Are you suggesting that the award was a bribe to undermine the union's honesty in its representation of workers?
Your Honor, I wish we knew.
Is that the argument?
No, it's not entirely okay. My argument. My argument is that the impayment of this money can be, if approved by this court in this manner, could be considered open up the floodgates for mechanisms to actually try to bypass 302.
Would you agree that the employer representatives approved the resolution of those grievances that were actually resolved by the JGC?
No, Your Honor. There is nothing in the record that indicates who actually ruled.
Is there any evidence that they did not approve? We know that the JGC has to operate by majority vote, right?
No.
We don't?
I'm going to agree with you. So long as there's equal composition
right.
of members.
Do we have any evidence, for example, from the folks who were there to represent the employers, that those rules were broken?
The only evidence we have are from the affidavits. And I don't believe the affidavits satisfy that question.
Well, it's your burden to show that there was a violation, correct?
Generally, yes.
You need to come forward with some evidence indicating, you know, for example, that the employer representatives didn't vote or were thrown out of the room or were coerced or something, right?
Your Honor, I think in some respects focusing on the ultimate vote is not our part of our case. Our part is the jurisdictional piece of the composition.
Okay, so I take it you don't have any evidence then that this was anything other than a majority vote of an equally constituted JGC.
Is that right? No, that's not exactly right either, because the argument was made, especially by Judge Kendall below, that the collective bargaining agreement's requirement of composition of equal numbers really meant just majority voting, and therefore implicit in her decision is the fact that there was no evidence, there was no majority, or the majority vote took place.
I'm still waiting for evidence that this was anything other than a majority vote.
I don't have that evidence.
Okay. You were referring to jurisdiction a moment ago.
Yes.
And Mr. Hanlon made those objections in terms of jurisdiction, in terms of whether step one and step two had been followed before the JGC got a hold of things. What exactly is meant by jurisdictional in that situation, and why aren't those things that the JGC could, by agreement between the union and the employers, decide to waive or go forward with?
The question of jurisdiction comes from Section 301 of the Labor Act and the fundamental policy that although the federal law encourages management and labor to enter into collective bargaining agreements because it has some sort of salutary effect, the proposition and preference also requires that the bargain that they get is the one that and the outcome they get is based upon the bargain they had. So what's the process?
Totally lost. Section 301 has to do with jurisdiction in the U.S. District Court. It doesn't have anything to do with whether union and management representatives can agree on a given grievance procedure.
I may be using 301 vis-a-vis the common law federal labor, common federal labor law.
In a way that just isn't sitting. Perhaps you would phrase it in some other way.
It's jurisdiction under the collective bargaining agreement, not in federal court. So maybe I apologize.
When we talk about it in federal court, jurisdiction means something that is hard and fast, cannot be waived. The committee has an obligation to raise it on its own. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that the requirements, for example, of having the Step 2 conference are jurisdictional in that sense?
Yes, they are.
And the committee can't decide to waive it because it would be futile?
Yeah. What in the collective bargaining agreement provides that the union and management representatives can't agree among themselves on certain issues of procedure?
There is nothing that along those lines, Your Honor, that they can't. They can't.
If you don't have anything that bans agreement, then you don't have the further step which says if they purported to agree, that would be ineffectual.
That part we have. If they purport to agree to a process that's not in the collective bargaining agreement, which is to alter or change the steps or the manner in which the steps are supposed to be had, then that is that breaches the contract. The language of the, within the at the hearing was pretty opprobrious. Mr. Sisko says to Mr. Hanlon repeatedly, "We're going to take an app if you give us any objections to our proceeding." I'm asking if are there any procedural rules I need to know about, and he answers, "Have you gone to first grade yet?" He indicates his bias and predisposition in the cases, especially 06 and 35, in which he says before the evidence is really going in, that the company owes them or owes us $250,000. And that starts from a grievance that he files, which is at about a $5,000 level. At the hearing becomes $137,000, and he's demanding $250,000 and thinks that's light change. And these are on the record comments indicating his predisposition and his bias and partiality. I don't think we can take that lightly. And whether or not especially his unwillingness to hear the objections and specifically telling Merriman, take your objections to court, take Marbury to court, we'll handle this later. When Merriman asks who's composing the Joint Grievance Committee, who are the members of the Joint Grievance Committee, he's told, we'll tell you later. He's assured that he's going to be told later by both Mr. Sisko and Marva Vignacci. And he's never told. In fact, when the decisions come out, we don't know who sat on the grievance committee. And the union admits in their interrogatory answer, I believe it's 5K, that they don't know who sat on the joint grievance committee either, because the decision, which only just says pay X amount of dollar to the union assistance fund, doesn't provide any other information. In that regard. Finally, Your Honor, I want to talk about the punitive aspect of giving money to the assistance fund, because that is outside the contract. It's not in the contract. The power that Judge Kendall looked at was the power of the Joint Grievance Committee to resolve grievances, but it didn't expand the remedy, like other collective bargaining agreements that this court is familiar with, that allows for joint grievance committees to issue fines and to form any sort of remedy that they think fits the violation. That's not this case. It's not this collective bargaining agreement. This bargaining agreement specifically said on assignment of work issues, which all these grievances were, that the remedy is two times the lost compensation to the bargaining unit employee, not to the union, not to the union assistance fund, of which we don't have a whole lot of information because there's not really none in the record except a statement by Mr. Sisko that they've done it before and they give it to people on hard times. But that doesn't necessarily, and it doesn't fit the collective bargaining agreement's rules. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Deamer.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Brian Diemer, and I represent the union in this matter. May it please the Court. This case involves the enforceability of 9 awards entered by the Joint Grievance Committee. The District Court decided cross motions for summary judgment in favor of Local 150, and in so doing, enforce those 9 awards. We ask this Court to affirm that decision in its entirety. I want to begin by discussing briefly the JGC proceedings that we're talking about. In 2006, over a span of several months, Local 150 filed 13 grievances alleging basically garden variety contract violations against the company. The party's collective bargaining agreement contains a grievance procedure designed to resolve grievances. The parties agreed to submit at the third step of the grievance procedure unresolved grievances to this Joint Labor Management Committee for possible resolution. If the committee is able to resolve a grievance by majority vote, it can do so, and that decision is final and binding. If the committee deadlocks, the union has the option to advance the grievance to the next and final step in the grievance procedure, which is arbitration. Union filed 13 grievances in August and October of 2006. The JGC convened hearings. The parties were able to settle 2 of those grievances at the hearing. The company wrote a check to the assistance fund to settle those grievances. 2 other grievances were deadlocked, meaning the committee was unable to resolve them by a majority vote. The union elected to advance one of those grievances to arbitration, and it dropped the other. As to the remaining 9 grievances, the JGC sustained 6 of those grievances in amounts less than that sought by the union, and it sustained 3 of those grievances in their entirety. For whatever reason, the company did not present a substantive defense on the merits to 5 of the grievances, grievances 0630, 32, 33, 51, and 59. The case that the company presents to this court is different than the case that it presented to the district court. The case below is principally a conspiracy case. The complaint that the company filed was 56 pages in length, contained 56 exhibits, and was basically a conspiracy case, containing a RICO count in count 13 and a state conspiracy claim in count 12. Their counts 1 through 11 were their suits to vacate these awards. The gist of the conspiracy claim was that all of the 13 named individual and institutional defendants conspired against the company to breach fiduciary duties they allegedly owed the company. The named defendants included grievants, included union business agents, and included members of the committee. With respect to the 301 suit to vacate, the company argued that the district court needed to vacate those awards because the local had failed to comply with various steps in the grievance procedure and that there were too many people in the room when they deliberated. That was the case that was presented to the district court. The district court rejected their claims, dismissing the RICO count on a Rule 12 motion and dismissing the state conspiracy claim along with their suit to vacate the awards on summary judgment. And again, as I said, there were cross motions, so at that time the district court granted Local 150's cross motion for summary judgment and enforced those awards. Having lost on that conspiracy theory and the theories advanced in their summary judgment papers, the company has now changed its theories and direction on appeal. We believe those arguments are not preserved for appellate review. I want to talk about joint grievance committees generally next. Local 150 argued from the outset in this case that decisions of joint grievance committees are treated as arbitration decisions for purposes of judicial review under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. The standard of review was not at issue below. A review of the summary judgment briefs reveals that the parties were analyzing this case through the same lens. We were dealing with the same body of law. And in fact, the company prevailed in a discovery dispute where it restated that the issue for the district court was to determine whether the awards drew their essence from the collective bargaining agreement, the common formulation that we see in the cases within this circuit and sister circuits as well. That discovery dispute and that discussion on the record before the district court is found at docket number 198 at page 12, lines 13 through 15. The company now argues for de novo review. Again, this was not presented to the district court, and it's at odds with existing Supreme Court authority and authority from this court, namely the Supreme Court cases General Drivers versus Riss and Company, RISS.
I think it would probably help us more if you were to get to the issues in this case rather than give us all this background, which I think we already have.
I understand, Your Honor. From our point of view, much of the case is waived. Waiver, we believe, operates at two different levels. First are the arguments that the company failed to present to the arbitrator, but raised for the first time to the district court, and then the arguments that the company raises for the first time on appeal. I want to address bias because the company raises this issue. Again, the case was a conspiracy case. Bias was not presented below. We believe that the statements raised by the company in its brief, that those were never presented to the district court, and they don't represent bias towards the company. The statements don't indicate hostility or animosity that any of the decision makers had towards the company. At most, they reflect a dissatisfaction with the way that the company's lawyer was presenting the case. There was definite friction between the company's lawyer and the committee. But those statements.
Why did the committee allow the company's lawyer? The collective bargaining agreement seems to have a clause that says that this presentation to the joint grievance board shall be without counsel on either side.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the discussion on the record reveals that Mr. Hanlon represented himself as a business agent or a business representative at those hearings and not a lawyer.
Do you think that rule is jurisdictional?
The rule about not allowing a lawyer mm-hmm. to be present?
Yeah.
I think it's a rule of procedure. Mm-hmm. I think dealing with the jurisdictional issue that Your Honor raised with my opponent, the company agreed to submit unresolved grievances to the Joint Grievance Committee. It had jurisdiction over these cases. Any of the flaws that were complained about to the district court were procedural in nature. Questions of procedural arbitrability under this court, under circuit law, provides that they are to be decided by the arbitrator in the first instance, reviewable under the...
I had two reasons for asking my question about presence of counsel. The wind-up is to lead to the question, how does one argue that a particular legal subject was forfeited by not being raised before the Joint Grievance Committee when the whole structure of this collective bargaining agreement is one in which the presentation of the Joint Grievance Committee is without benefit of counsel and is informal? The contention, which you talked the district judge into, that an employer forfeits its position by not articulating them as a lawyer would in making an argument to a court before the Joint Grievance Committee seems very weak when lawyers are forbidden before the Joint Grievance Committee. So why should there be a forfeiture?
Well, in this case, there was a lawyer present, so and Mr. Hanlon conceded in his deposition that he was, in fact, practicing law. So any concerns that the court may have about a layperson not preserving an argument
The district judge said it's a rule of law that if you don't make a particular procedural argument before the Joint Grievance Committee, it's forfeited and you can never make it later. I'm asking whether it makes sense to have such a rule when lawyers are prohibited before the Joint Grievance Committee. Does it make sense to have such a rule?
Your Honor, lawyers are not prohibited from being in attendance. What lawyers are prohibited from doing is speaking to
can't
the...
Can't do anything, right?
You can advise
the
client.
So the kinds of things that a lawyer would do, making objections, right, presenting legal arguments and so on, they're all prohibited.
The lawyer can be there to advise, and frequently they are there. Again, the objections in this case that we're talking about, step one requires that the parties take up the grievance. This is typically done at the job site. I mean, this is an extension of collective bargaining that happens all across the country on a daily basis. The company's argument was that the union didn't take up the grievance. They were doing it with phone calls, meeting at the job site. So these arguments were... The company was able to preserve some of those arguments, but not all. The district court analyzed the grievances individually and separately, considering which arguments and which objections were made and preserved at the hearing. Those that weren't, the district court held, were waived. And again, the company's business representative conceded at his deposition that he was practicing law, so the company was the company's interests were protected by an attorney.
It sounds like then what you're saying is it would be okay to hold Merriman and Mr. Hanlon to that provision, but not to others who abide by the rules and don't come with a lawyer. Is that right?
First of all, I don't think that's this case. But secondly, the rule in this circuit is that joint boards are basically treated as arbitrations. And there are some arbitration provisions in outside collective bargaining agreements that don't allow lawyers to. It's the standard. The point of the JGC, the Joint Committee, and joint committees generally, is, again, it's an extension of collective bargaining. These are the management representatives and the union representatives that negotiate these contracts. What they're trying to do is...
I can understand the argument that this is all irrelevant. That is, that this, the outcome of the Joint Grievance Committee, should be treated just as if this were a resolution at step two. And the employer's representative had said, okay, we agree with the grievance, we're paying, right? All that's happened at step three is that the employer is being represented by people sent in by this multi-employer bargaining unit. It's all just a matter of contract. I can understand that argument. The point I'm, question I'm making is there some separate argument that this should be treated as if this were some kind of judicial proceeding in which arguments have to be made or they're forfeited? I mean, that's my problem here.
My reading of the law provides that forfeiture occurs if an objection is made, is not made at an arbitration or a joint board, and then made later on in the district court. And that's...
This is not an arbitration. It's really a completely different kind of proceeding. Anyway, let me ask you a different question, something that's been bugging me here. There's a provision in the National Labor Relations Act, it's 29 U.S.C. Section 186, which prohibits employers from making direct payments to unions. Now, the Joint Grievance Committee ordered the employer to make direct payments to the union, not to the workers, but to the union. Doesn't that violate Section 186?
I think C2 provides that that an employer can make a payment to a union to adjust a grievance or to satisfy an award from an impartial arbitrator or a joint committee.
Not an arbitrator.
Or a joint, and I believe that in C2 they...
C2 includes joint grievance committees?
I believe that they talk about committees.
All right, well, that may be the answer. I was then going to say, in any event, that Merriman hasn't relied on 186, but it was bugging me.
I'd just like to follow up on that a minute on this assistance fund. Who distributes out of that?
Right.
Is it something about people that were out of jobs or something to back it up? But that seems like a pretty powerful amount of money that's not designated to an individual as a result of the decision.
The problem with this case and grievances like it is that the allegation was that the company failed to utilize the hiring hall procedure. So a company that has to fill a position, the procedure in place is that they call the union, call the hiring hall, ask the union to dispatch an employee. This local is a large local spanning going to South Bend on the east to the Quad Cities on the west. There are multiple districts. So the union has a procedure that it tries to fill the job within district first. If it can't fill the job there, it goes outside district. The union has 48 hours under the agreement to fill the position, and if the union can't, then the company can what we call hire off the bank. So that's the procedure. Now, what the allegations of the grievances in this case were that the company didn't utilize the hiring hall procedure. So it's nearly impossible to identify precisely the member who would have been on the out-of-work list at the precise time the company would have made the call to the assistance.
Were there people out of work?
I think there was council cites an offhanded comment by counsel for Local 150 in an injunction hearing. Some of the grievances, the hiring grievances, occurred in April. Again, there was no discovery taken on this. But
didn't you all resist that?
On the hiring hall?
Discovery on the hiring list, the out-of-work list?
I don't believe that there was any formal discovery request.
There was a request, right?
I believe that there might have been a request at the hearing.
Now, what legitimate reason is there for not answering that, particularly where we've got this issue about who should be compensated?
Well, I think there's two issues. First of all, that's just not information the committee would have in front of it. Secondly, the injury is to the union. The failure to hire through the hiring hall provision means that a non-union employee is doing that work over the course of months and days. The next person on the hiring hall list, had the company followed it, may have been dispatched to another job the following day. So that person's injury may be only one day in length, but the job was continued to be performed by a non-union worker over the month.
I thought your position wasn't that the union was the injured party, but rather that unidentifiable union members were the injured parties. Did I misunderstand that?
I think that the union is the party that has the contract with the employer. So when the employer violates the contract, it's the union that's injured. The injury to bargaining unit members, as we try to define who is actually injured, if there's a worker, the injury reverberates through the hiring hall list, because if the next person on the list was out of work for 2 days, he got a job, that injury reverberates through the list. Some of these awards were large, representing the wages and hours that a 150 member would have earned had it worked for several weeks. So providing that money to an individual member is a windfall. The injury to that first member, the next guy on the out-of-work list, his injury may have only been 2 days, but the guy behind him had an injury for 2 days, and so on and so on. And so there's just no way to calculate that injury. So instead, the money goes to the assistance fund. The assistance fund is maintained by the union and pays out benefits upon formal application to members in need. Currently, it's being used to make COBRA payments to out-of-work bargaining unit members. Again, with respect to remedies, it's a tenet of federal labor national labor policy that arbitrators need to have flexibility in fashioning awards that can reasonably be said to cure the breach. The collective bargaining agreement gives the JGC the authority to resolve grievances before it. As the district court pointed out in its decision, there's nothing that limits the ability, the JGC's ability to award remedies, and we believe that the award to the assistance fund was proper. Incidentally, there in counsel's reply brief, they point out that a citation that Local 150 made in our brief was inaccurate. Just so the record is clear, I double-checked that site again last night, and we stand by that site about the history of the assistance fund and the fact that the JGC has made payments to the assistance fund over the years in these types of cases. In the event that this court is persuaded by any of Merriman's arguments, the most expansive remedy this court may award is a remand to further proceedings before the JGC. This comes out of the Supreme Court case, Major League Baseball versus Steve Garvey. The issue, again, courts aren't in the position to reweigh the merits of grievances, nor are courts in the position to reweigh remedies. Those issues are best left for the JGC. And, again, the final point I'd like to make is that the company's opening brief in various sections asks this court to essentially reweigh the merits of grievances, challenging the propriety of them. And, again, it took the position below that the merits of the grievances were not at issue, and therefore they are not at issue any longer. So if there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court in its entirety.
Thank you, Mr. Deamer. Anything further, Mr. Avakian?
Yes, sir. I want to clarify the answer to Judge Mannion's questions about the whether there was evidence of unequal voting or unequal membership. And I would refer the court to the Attorney Hensel's deposition, which is on Joint Appendix page 558, actual page 38, where she was a person who was in attendance in almost all these sessions as an attorney for Local 150. And she testifies, I do not know that the voting contingents of the labor management on the JGC were equal.
She doesn't know.
She doesn't know. And she was there. The point being that based upon somebody who was present who doesn't know, the burden on us is that...
Did you ask the employer reps? Did they get outvoted?
We don't know, Your Honor. As much as we got are in the affidavits, which was some people voted, somebody voted. We don't have it from the final documents.
With respect to bias, there is no question of
counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement. We'll